This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Isabella Pittaway with you for the Country Hour this Monday. Coming up this half hour, as the drought puts pressure on many farming businesses, we'll hear from the Riverland citrus and cropping farmers who are turning to crickets for an alternative income.
Even with the rainfall that we've had this year, we can grow more than enough crickets. So, and that's just purely because how much water they use. They use next to nothing compared to cattle farming or cropping, chicken farming, piggeries. Like, it's incredible how sustainable they are.
Also today, Wine Australia launches its biggest ever marketing campaign to win back US consumers. The United States is the world's largest wine market with an estimated retail value of $38 billion, more than double that of China. So we'll find out how Wine Australia plans to get back in on that US market. But first today, and drought has cut the number of pastoralists looking to buy rams this year. Despite that, growers from as far away as Kangaroo Island flocked to Springvale North Stud near Burra to see what was on offer. Lucas Forbes reports.
Carcass, wool cut, a real money maker. Look at that sheep's got. Lot number 40 wins.
At Springvale North's Paul Marino stud sale, the grass is green, the rams are huge, and the clients are buying. However, Springvale North's Peter Stockman says it's been a tough season for them, with the worst start to the year he's ever seen.
Yeah, no, very well, considering the season that we've had in this area and, to the north, definitely. A big percentage of our ram clients are to the north of us, and the support they've shown us been fantastic through tough times. But sale held up very well. Got 100% clearance, and average price only dropped about $50 on last year. Top price had gained $100, so very happy.
So what was the top price?
Top price was $5,600 for a merino medium wool ram that went to Adelaide Show. It placed quite well in the classes down there.
And what's your average price?
We averaged just shy of $1,500, so very happy. Good value for buying.
Landmark Burra livestock agent Alistair Keller says orders from pastoralists have dropped from last year.
The pastoral orders are probably back again from what it was last year. Some fellas in the pastoral country still had a few ewes last year and made it up, where this year it's been so dry up there they've had to offload a lot of ewes. And so we probably don't quite have the pastoral orders that we did have last year.
Could you give me an idea? What's the change from the pastoral orders? Do you have any figures that could put that in context?
There's some fellas up there that have would sort of normally buy 50 to 60 rams that last year sort of only bought 20 or 30, and this year haven't bought any at all. So, last year they probably bought half the amount of rams that they normally would, where this year a lot of those pastoral fellas aren't even buying any at all. So,
however, Mr. Keller says growers in the grazing areas are still turning up and buying animals.
Yeah, we've had a pretty strong following from the inside country. We've been lacking a few orders from the pastoral country, obviously being so dry up north, and into the eastern country of Burra here. But the inside fellas have taken the opportunity, I guess, to grab a few extra rams when they've had to in a year like this.
With the sale done and dusted for another year, Mr. Stockman says despite a break in the season in May, he and others will be looking to the skies for some relief.
Start of the season, it was probably the worst this area had looked for as long as I can remember, sort of up to May. It was just, wind swept, bare. But May got us back on track. We had about 60 mil and, got seeding underway. And, we sowed a lot more country just to get some cover back on. It's basically been pretty good ever since. Still sitting on the edge, needing another rain very shortly.
2,000 items 17, same as the last.
That's Springvale North's Peter Stockman ending that report from Lucas Forbes. Not sure how much rain really is on the radar. It is a bit of a mixed bag for the weather this week, and we'll have all the details later on. When beach volleyball player Zachary Schubert began a degree in nutrition, he didn't expect to emerge as a cricket farmer. Zach and his father Tim Schubert run a cropping and citrus farm in the Riverland, but limited water availability has meant low yields in recent years, so they decided to diversify their business by farming crickets. Grace Whiteside reports.
Tim and Zachary Schubert started breeding crickets in a shipping container at their family farm in Pyap near Loxton earlier this year. Zachary studies nutrition and exercise science and says it's shown him the benefits of farming insects.
Through my studies, I've come across more looking like the nutritional value of food and the more sustainable, like, or how sustainable is that food for the environment and for planet Earth. Through that kind of that avenue, and also travelling overseas and seeing the insects overseas and how people eat and consume other different foods, crickets just kind of came, and it all just kind of came together in like one big ball.
He says his studies have shown crickets can be used as an alternative food source.
That's the whole reason why I set out to like start breeding crickets, is for the purpose of human consumption. They say that some of the bigger farmers here in Australia, they've had anywhere between 60 to 70% protein. So in 100 grams of crickets, there's 60 grams of protein, which is huge. That's three times the amount of protein than beef.
Zachary says he hopes the insects will be a viable source of income in dry times in the future.
Even with the rainfall that we've had this year, we can grow more than enough crickets. So, and that's just purely because how much water they use. They use next to nothing compared to cattle farming or cropping, chicken farming, piggeries. Like, it's incredible how sustainable they are. So even in the years that we're having right now, we'd be able to farm crickets. And I don't see why the Riverland can't be the hub of cricket farming for Australia.
Zachary's dad, Tim, says this year has been particularly tough on the farm.
The crops were hanging in. It's very... we've actually been quite lucky with 60 mils of rain. But, yeah, they just this last week, the crops have really gone downhill quick. So we've had little showers to keep them going, but we've had no subsoil moisture. Like last year, we had a lot of subsoil moisture down deep, which kept the crops going. This year, there's nothing. There was nothing to start with.
He says it was a huge surprise when his son first suggested farming crickets.
Well, we went down to Adelaide one day and he's got crickets in his carport down in the house down Adelaide. And I want to breed these, Dad. Yeah, so then it just went on that way, and we had to bring them home because he was going overseas to play volleyball. So I brought them home. I looked after them for a couple of weeks, and then you can have them back. Yeah, he was so, yeah, I don't know. He was so happy to do something like this, so we might as well bring it home here.
The two now breed the crickets together.
Over time, I slowly convinced Dad to get on board, and he's on board now, and I'm loving it, because without his support, it would not be possible. He's a huge key player.
He hopes to have 50,000 in each shipping container in the near future to help increase the profitability of the business.
It wouldn't even cover costs, what we're getting now, so I would nearly say three containers at least before you actually start making any money. It's sort of only a hobby at the moment, but it is quite surprising how many people, even in the Riverland, require crickets. Oh, everything you do in this life is a risk. The Australian public is probably... The whole idea is to try and go to human consumption, but the Australian government, I don't know, the Australian public, I don't know if they'll be able to, you know, I don't know what their views of it all, of eating crickets.
Professor at the University of Adelaide, Kerry Wilkinson, says it's about encouraging the public to be more accepting of consuming insects.
I think there are lots of reasons for why we might want to consume them and incorporate them into our diets, so from their nutritional properties, but also through to environmental reasons. So generally we explain it as crickets need less water, less feed and less space compared to traditional livestock. So there are lots of reasons why we should be eating them. The fact that, you know, insects offer a genuine solution to some of the food security issues that we might not experience in Australia right now, but they might be coming in the future. So some of these warmer and drier conditions are going to make it more challenging for farmers to grow crops or to farm livestock. And so it means that these resources are going to become less available, and then when they are available, they're going to become more expensive.
She says the industry is currently working on producing some guidelines.
So some of that regulation in terms of food safety is in place now, but I think it's really around giving producers some surety around, you know, what some of the best practices in terms of what feedstocks to use and how to process insects that will really make it easier for, you know, for producers to enter the food market, you know, particularly for human consumption.
Zachary agrees it's important.
Just some guidelines, I think, is probably what we really need. So just a consistent guideline across Australia about what we need for growing crickets. And I think that will really impact in a positive way, because everyone will be doing it the same way, and everyone will be on the same page with how to grow them and what's the best way to do it and what's the safest way to do it for human consumption.
This Riverland local is looking to support the region he loves.
I'd love to be able to supply and support families in the region. I love this town. I love everything about the Riverland. It has had such a positive impact on my upbringing, and I want more people to experience that by finding ways to help the community, to create jobs, to find different ways of living. I think it's a huge goal of mine.
That is cricket farmer Zachary Schubert ending that report by Grace Whiteside. And they're definitely on the menu, crickets. I've had some crickets in the form of tortilla chips, and they actually have a bit of a fishy taste, interestingly enough. I'd love to hear from you. If you are diversifying, what are you going into? Anything is out there as moving into cricket? 0467 922 783. I'd love to hear how you've diversified, or if you're thinking about diversifying, what are you looking at moving into? 0467 922 783. Well, it's 16 past 12. Let's talk about those small little bugs that love to eat poo and improve soils. Yes, I'm talking about dung beetles. Researchers from Charles Sturt University are eagerly awaiting the birth of about 7,000 special baby dung beetles. The Ovaca beetles come from Morocco, and they will be the first of three new species to be introduced to sites across Australia. But why do we need these new species of dung beetles? Well, Professor Leslie Weston says it's simple. They're better at eating sheep and cattle poo than our native dung beetles.
So the project is looking at first importing an additional three species that are known to work effectively at shredding or integrating dung into the soil. And this, in particular, would be with cattle and potentially grazing sheep. So we're interested in working with the imported species that are more effective in distributing larger quantities of non-native herbivores, like cattle, their dung, which is heavy, wet, and produced in high abundance. Our native beetles, we have 500 species here in Australia, are much more adapted to marsupial, drier dung in smaller quantities.
With Australia's strict quarantine laws, I understand there was quite a process to get the beetles into Australia. What happens?
Yes, it's an expensive and time-consuming process. So once the beetles are collected from their native region, in this case, Northern Africa or Morocco, we picked beetles from this region because we thought they would be well adapted to inland climates and temperature and moisture extremes, similar to what we might experience in Australia seasonally. We also picked this beetle because it's spring active, and currently we don't have many examples of spring active beetles in Australia. So we're looking for year-round activity in the beetles that we do have. We worked with CSIRO, who is handling the importation, and they have organized all the paperwork and the activities that have to happen in their Mediterranean quarantine facility.
The passports?
Where the beetle, yes, in France, and the beetle there is essentially cleaned and almost near sterilized, and then it eggs are sent over in brood bowls to be hatched and reared at CSIRO. So that minimizes the potential for contamination or introduction of other organisms. So once that occurs, they go through a few generations of increase, and now we've had enough abundance of those beetles to actually allow us at CSU to start to mass rear them in even greater numbers. And that's where we are in the process.
Some of the beetles will end up in the Midwest near Mingenew, and the Mingenew Irwin Group's going to be involved with the project later down the track. What benefits are you hoping that these beetles will provide to the livestock industry?
And the reason dung beetles are so important is that they deliver a number of ecosystem services to the producer. This includes getting rid of dung on the soil surface, so that can reduce fly and pest burdens for livestock and also reduce fly populations, which can have an effect on humans as well. They also incorporate the dung, which is high in nutrients, particularly nitrogen, into the soil, so we can prevent runoff of nitrogen, but we can also hope to obtain a healthier pasture, better soil texture, because the dung beetles incorporate and aerate the soil. And then potentially they also sequester carbon.
They do sound like handy little critters. How can farmers encourage dung beetles on their property?
So at this point, there are several producers who commercially raise dung beetles or they collect them in the field and are happy to work with producers to distribute them on their farm. In the future, after we distribute beetles more regionally across Australia, the hope is that they'll successfully adapt, reproduce, and then obviously they'll move and spread, and they can be recollected and redistributed from on-farm mass rearing sites.
That's Professor Leslie Weston from Charles Sturt University speaking there with Lucinda Joes.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It is 22 past 12. Well, for 5 years, researchers have been analysing canola crops growing across New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia and Queensland. Finding the ideal timing for sowing, flowering, windrowing and harvest was a major focus of the project. New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, Pulses and Oilseeds Technical Specialist Don McCaffrey says their research findings can help growers improve their bottom line.
We did a lot of detailed work on phenology, so that's when the crop gets to certain growth stages. And with canola, we've got a great range now where we're trying to match sowing date and variety so that the crop flowers in the lowest risk period of the year, which is generally late July through August.
Has that told you much that you didn't already know about canola?
It certainly has, because quite a few years ago there was much less varieties, and now we've got about 50 with a huge diversity in phenology. We didn't know when the critical period was, where the crop needs, I guess, water and nitrogen in the system, and what the main drivers are of yield, and also which varieties we can, providing we get the break or we've got the subsoil moisture where we can sow earlier with certain varieties, which we would never have done 15 or 20 years ago. We would have tried to start sowing on Anzac Day, but we know we can go much earlier. And I guess that's just allowing us to grab an opportunity if it presents itself.
And so from this research, what's the earliest date now that you'd say for people to be able to put in canola?
Oh, for the long season springs, we've got winter canola in the system now that we didn't have 10 years ago. So you can actually plant that, believe it or not, you can plant that at the end of this year and not harvest it to the end of next year and graze it for a long period of time. But the long season springs, probably the last week in March, first week in April. But we know with some varieties that are not late maturity, but they're held back early in their growth stage, so that you could perhaps sow them in mid-April or 10th of April, where you wouldn't have contemplated that 10 years ago.
And then you spoke about the critical periods for it, for nitrogen and moisture. What is that critical period that you've been able to hone in on?
Well, it's called a critical growth period, and it's been identified for a whole heap of crops and never for canola, not even globally. So in Australia, researchers have done barley, peas, chickpeas, wheat. So it is in that, it's in late winter. I can't give you specific dates. So I crop my flower for 6 to 8 weeks. So we want the start of flowering to be in the optimum period where frost risk, increasing heat stress, well, it's not cold in August, but if you're out later, you will run into heat stress and moisture stress. So I was trying to manage those three variables as well as disease risk so that the crop falls into that period. Doesn't mean to say you're out of trouble, as you know the way the seasons have been going, but it's trying to manage that risk.
And speaking of seasons, how are farmers going about managing those risks during a particularly dry time like this that a lot of regions are experiencing? How's the canola looking?
Well, unfortunately, south of the Murrumbidgee River here, it's still okay, but there's not much water underneath the crop. And we know from out west, you only have to go to the Newell Highway, I suppose, and crops are being cut for either silage or hay, silage first and then hay. And in central New South Wales, I think most of the crop now is unlikely to make grain. But, I mean, that's just been a total lack of rainfall that's led to that. But it has, I guess, for those blokes that have, or those farmers that have got an opportunity to make hay, they are able to recover their costs, if not even make a profit. But that's not, unfortunately, some crops didn't even emerge this year, such how dry it was.
And then speaking of hay making and windrowing and harvest, what's your research found in heading towards the end of the season?
Well, with windrowing, the traditional, recommendations, or the old recommendations, was 40 to 60% of seed colour change on the main stem. But we've found through this research that somewhere between 25 and 30% of yield comes off the main stem, and the rest of it, which is 80 to 75%, comes off the branches. So you've got to be looking at the branches because that's where most of the yields come from. So we're now recommending 60% seed colour change on the whole plant, but the middle third of the plant, but the whole plant, including the branches. And we know that could, depending on when, if you went a little bit earlier with lower seed colour change, it could be up to $200 a hectare on a 1.5 tonne per hectare crop.
Once the windrows are done and then it's to harvest, any tips and tricks you found with the research that growers should know about?
No, we didn't particularly go into that, but we did go into, we did do the windrowing work, and we did do a little bit of work with the Podguard varieties. There's only a couple on the market, but what we do, even with the Podguard, so that's pod shatter tolerance. You just can't leave the crop out there for 6 weeks because it will lose weight, and not the pods, but the branches will break if we have, bad wind and rain and storms and.
And will that be made worse in a year like this where it could be quite dry if there's no spring rain now? Will that be made worse come harvest time?
I suspect it will be because the crop will be just that much more brittle. And, it's the worst nightmare this year when you think about a crop that's normally senescing, so just maturing normally, versus a crop that's dying at the same time because it's just out of water. So I don't have any solutions to that.
That's Don McCaffrey from the New South Wales Department of Primary Industry speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're going to be hearing from Wine Australia because they're about to launch their biggest marketing campaign to try and get back into the world's biggest wine market, and that is the United States. A text here to 0467 922 783. Martin says, "G'day. As far as wine marketing is concerned, with the USA trade sanctions and the massive underdeveloped Chinese market, would that not be a better opportunity to sell our wines?" Well, we're going to hear from Wine Australia as to why they chose the US, but currently it is the world's biggest wine market, and it's worth $38 billion, which is more than double that of the Chinese market. But right now, Viterra has loaded its 100th train with grain headed to New South Wales as the company looks to meet ongoing domestic demand. The trains, mainly loaded with wheat and barley, have been going to sites such as feedlots. Viterra operations manager Michael Hill says Viterra is not known for its domestic sales, but they are starting to do it more often.
It's relatively new this year. Obviously, it is our 100th train. We haven't seen the lower stock levels for quite some time. So we've actually done minimal domestic trains since probably the early 2007. And obviously, it's all related around dry conditions and the changing grain flows in South Australia going to the eastern states. So, yes, it's a change for us for quite some time.
So that's just because of the demand that's coming from New South Wales. They're looking for it.
That's correct. You know, obviously, they've had dry conditions over there and, you know, predominantly we've always basically a export focused. So to do our domestic trains like this, you know, it's taken quite a bit of work with the buyers and the end users to make sure we're meeting their requirements as well. So it's been quite a challenge.
But what sort of adjustments do you have to make going to just supplying locally?
I think the thing is, if we're doing a 50,000 tonne export vessel, there's actually the same amount of complexity around it to do a 2,000 or 3,000 tonne vessel. You know, some of these trains have had four different commodities and grades. There's ownership at a number of small sites that we have to coordinate. And the different train locations and sizes, we've had different providers and they've got different sizes, different types of trains. So it's quite a change for our business.
So the 100th train has gone through. What sort of size trains are they in carriages and what sort of tonnages are they taking?
Oh, some go from 1,500 tonne to 2,500 tonnes. So depending on the rail provider, sometimes we do it all out of predominantly out of our major sites like Gladstone, Bowmans, Snowtown, Tail and Bend. And again, sometimes it'll have to be out of a smaller site depending on where ownership is.
And what sort of grain is being sent?
It's predominantly wheat and barley, a little bit of canola, but mainly for feedlots and is the predominant grades.
Now, this 100th train went to New South Wales, but you are supplying other states as well?
Yes, we are. There's quite a bit from our eastern sites going by road into Victoria as well. So, and we also have done some coastal vessels that go up around into Queensland and go get discharged and then are moved by road into the domestic market. So it's actually with road, rail and coastal vessels. And again, that'll come back to what the customer requires initially and then we'll facilitate that outcome for them.
Just onto the farmers here in South Australia, what sort of opportunities are there by having these extra customers coming to Viterra and wanting grain?
I think the positive for the growers is there's buyers and end-use customers in New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland who traditionally purchased grain in the eastern states have become buyers in the Viterra system. So many of them have sourced South Australian grain for the first time. So it's actually opened up markets for our South Australian growers. And it's added multiple buyers to the Viterra system, which is a positive.
And I guess also maybe Viterra is also acting as that, I guess, that bit of a middleman for the farmer and the customer to save them maybe things on freight and things like that.
For sure. You know, we'll facilitate the movements from road into the railheads and then obviously the rail into the endpoint destination. So we will accommodate and organise all that for them.
And Michael, can you see this this continuing sending off grain to different states, even if the seasons do get better?
I think so. You know, some of the clients now that they can see the opportunities for South Australian grain to go into the East Coast. So, you know, the potential is that it may continue to happen. But again, you know, we'll come back to working out what our customers and end use requirements are, and we'll just work through with those guys to help them, you know, achieve what they need to achieve for their business.
That's Viterra Operations Manager Michael Hill speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. It is after 12:30 on the Country Hour, so let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Anita Butcher.
Hi, Isabella. The National Party has voted for the scrapping of the requirement for 450 gigalitres of environmental water to be returned to the Murray-Darling system. The SA branch, however, voted against the Victorian branch's motion, which got up by a margin of just 2 votes, at the Nationals Federal Council over the weekend. SA Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young will today move a motion in the Senate to condemn the Nationals' decision. The number of drowning deaths in South Australia has dropped by 7% on last year. The national report by the Royal Life Saving Society showed 14 people drowned across the state in the 12 months, starting from July 2018. Dave Backus from Life Saving SA, says a significant number of deaths happened at high-risk coastal areas. And the state's transport minister says he's committed to saving offensive teddy bears on a York Peninsula highway. Thousands of bears have been strung along a fence on the Copper Coast Highway between Culpara and Paskerville since 2017. but the children's tourist attraction has garnered criticism over road safety because it inhibits motorists' ability to stop on the highway and causes drivers to slow where the speed limit is 100 kilometres an hour. 21,000 Teddy lovers have voted in an online survey to save the bears, and Transport Minister Stephen Knoll says he'll sit down to see what can be done to keep the teddies in place. And there'll be more news at 1.
Thanks, Anita. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now and say hello to Senior Forecaster John Fisher. Hi, John.
G'day, Isabella.
Now, it was really great this morning. I woke up early to the sound of rain on the roof, which was a nice change.
Yeah, that's right. We have seen some rainfall over the probably southeastern parts of the state, mainly with a band of middle-level cloud pushing through. So, yeah, yesterday it was over the southern districts, and we saw up to 9 a.m. this morning falls of probably 2 to 5 millimetres over those southern districts, with Mount Gambier seeing the highest total of 6.2 millimetres there. Since 9 a.m., that band has just gradually pushed north. It's currently situated up through the mid-north and out through the Riverland there, and since 9 a.m. we've seen further falls of 2 to 5 millimetres through the mid-north and Riverland. So, yeah, look, a little bit of rainfall, probably not as much as people are after, but, yeah, we'll take what we can get. So, yeah, look, for the remainder of today, that band will just contract north and clear the eastern parts of the state this evening. And we generally have a moderate to fresh south-to-south-easterly airstream over the remainder of the state with a high situated in the Bight. The wind's getting a bit stronger through the northeast pastoral and Flinders, so possibly even some raised dust up there this afternoon and evening. But, yeah, for most parts of the state, we're looking at dry conditions for the remainder of today. Look, as we move through the next couple of days, that high does move to our south and out into the Tasman Sea by later Tuesday, so fairly fast-moving feature. As it does move to our south, we're going to see some fairly cool mornings, so particularly tomorrow morning, we're likely to see some widespread areas of frost through central and eastern districts and maybe even over parts of inland Eyre Peninsula as well. So, yeah, look, pretty chilly morning there, and we might even be issuing some frost warnings for those conditions, but generally it's going to be a dry day tomorrow, and looking at sunny conditions as well for most of the state. As we move through the week there, look, Wednesday, again another dry day as that high is situated out in the Tasman, bringing us a strengthening northeast to northerly airstream, certainly freshening in the west where we could even see some raised dust and temperatures really coming back up as well. So, obviously a little bit cooler today with those southerly winds, but by Wednesday, certainly looking at some much warmer temperatures, looking at low to mid 20s for much of the state, but reaching the low to mid 30s and even the high 30s in the far west. So temperatures out there are going to be around 10 to 14 degrees above average for the parts of the west coast and northwest pastoral on Wednesday. And then during Thursday, we see a pretty significant cold front. So the first real strong cold front that we've seen this spring move across western and central parts of the state. Ahead of that feature, we're looking at very strong northerly winds developing for much of the state. So it's likely we'll see warnings being issued for those winds there on Thursday. And those northerly winds will drag that heat right across remaining parts of the state. So looking at pretty much hot conditions for this time of the year on Thursday there. And those winds are likely to also whip up a bit of raised dust. So, a pretty ugly day there on Thursday with those strong winds, warm, strong winds and raised dust. But we do see later in the afternoon and evening some showers and possible thunderstorms developing generally with and behind that front. So it'll start over western parts of the state, so Eyre Peninsula, northwest pastoral, and then just gradually increase and contract eastwards into Friday. Looking at not huge amounts of rainfall for Thursday there, but as we move into Friday with that band really consolidating and contracting east, it might even tend to rain at times about some central and eastern parts, and then we'll continue to contract east over the remainder of the state with a much cooler southwesterly airstream to follow. So cumulative rainfall totals up to midnight Friday there. Generally looking at 1 to 5 millimetres for the majority of the state, except the far inland western areas and northeast of the state. But we are likely to see falls of around 5 to 10 millimetres for parts of the central and eastern districts, particularly with that band of showers and thunderstorms developing later in the week. And possibly some local higher falls if we do see some concentrated thunderstorm activity there as well. And beyond that, for the weekend and into early next week, we're looking at much cooler, below average temperatures and just a general onshore wind flow. So looking at some showers, isolated showers generally about western coasts and the remainder of the agricultural area, and a return to frost for some inland parts as well. So much cooler conditions there, but before then, looking at some dry conditions before a very warm and windy day there on Wednesday.
A short burst of summer there, and doesn't sound like good conditions on the Thursday. I mean, in terms of bushfires, you'd assume that that's a high risk day, given what you've said.
Yeah, look, certainly it's a bit early in the season, so it's a really start to talk about fire weather, but you're right, it certainly is that type of situation where we have to be vigilant, particularly in those parts of the state where it has been quite dry and we don't have that green vegetation that we'd usually have.
John, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That is John Fisher at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the Upper Western District, a mostly sunny day with a medium chance of showers in the southeast in the early morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 4 and 10, and daytime temperatures will reach between 18 and 22. For the Lower Western District, a mostly sunny day with a slight chance of a shower in the far east in the early morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to around 3, and daytime temperatures will reach around 18 degrees.
Picture this: ABC Radio in your car, streaming online via the ABC Listen app, and now ABC Radio on your TV. ABC Radio is everywhere, anywhere, even on your TV. From RN and News Radio to Double J, ABC Kids Listen, and your local capital city ABC radio station. Search your TV's electronic program guide to find your favourites. ABC Radio. Hear it on your TV.
You are listening to the Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway, and it is 18 minutes to one. A text here you might have heard in the news, the petition about the teddies on the fence on the, I think it was the Copper Coast Highway, but it was near Pascoville anyway. Ted here saying, nothing nice about the stuffed toys hanging on fences. They're not looked after. They look awful, waterlogged. They're mouldy and they need removing. 0467 922 783, if you'd like to join the conversation today on the Country Hour. But some good news now for River Murray irrigators, and that is that South Australia's water allocations have risen to 81%. That's up from the 74% announced earlier this month and 14% which was announced back in April, and it is likely that water allocations will reach 100%. Well, to another story now, and that is Wine Australia is launching its biggest ever marketing campaign to try and get back into the world's biggest wine market, and that's the United States. The $8 million Far From Ordinary campaign will include roadshows targeting big wine drinking cities such as New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. I spoke to Wine Australia's regional general manager for the Americas, Aaron Ridgway, who says it hopes to increase Australia's exports to the US by $50 million by the end of June next year.
The US is a market that's incredibly important. It's the biggest wine market in the world. It's the most sophisticated wine market in the world. And we have won here before. We had a very successful run through the 90s and into the 2000s. And yeah, we really looked at the grant as an opportunity to to kind of accelerate us getting back on the right footing and setting ourselves up to have a bright future here.
We sort of dipped
off. Massive priority.
Well, and we sort of dipped off for a bit. How come?
So it's a good question. The global financial crisis happened at a time when Australian wine was benefiting a lot from, you know, disposable income, and, you know, consumers that were drinking wine had really gravitated to Australia. I think there's also a case of saturation. You know, we had the number one wine brand in the country at the time, and we were the darling of, you know, wine publications giving high scores to our wines. And I think as any trends do or movements do, you know, consumers moved on. They wanted to try something else. And I think the final factor there is exchange rates. So the Australian dollar went from very competitive to trading to incredibly uncompetitive. I think it was $1.06 or $1.07. So the margin went away for wineries who were exporting. And, you know, there was just a little bit of a shift in consumer taste that was not favourable for us. So our sales declined. We were, I think, almost $950, $960 million in the year 2007. And we came back to earth and have spent the last decade or so working very carefully to make sure that our footprint and the way we go to market is sustainable and putting our best foot forward.
And this leads to now what is Wine Australia's biggest ever promotion of Australian wine, and I think also their biggest marketing campaign at $8 million. Can you tell us a little bit about the campaign and how you're hoping to sort of win back that US market?
Sure. So the category has been repositioning itself over the last few years. We've seen, you know, we've been losing some volume under $10 a bottle on shelf, and that's what we call the grocery channel. So, you know, people are still grabbing Australian wine, but they're buying a bit less of it at, you know, sub $10 prices, but they're starting to grab it a bit more over $10. And as you and I both know, over $10 is where you start to see, you know, regional appellation, great stories, and the quality just keeps, you know, getting better and better the further you go over $10 a bottle. So what we've done with Aussie Wine Month and Far From Ordinary is say, all right, we know the average US consumer knows what Australia is, even if they don't know much about the depth and the quality of our wine offering. So about a year and a half ago, Wine Australia CEO Andreas and myself and a board member at the time travelled around the US, and we met with ownership at national distributors and, you know, category managers at very influential retailers that were national and regional, and also some of the top media. And we sort of said, we've got some investment coming. We know that US consumers like Australian wine. What could we do? So it was a bit of a listening to a bit of a strategy session that lasted a couple of weeks. And they all said, people love Shiraz, people love Australian wine. There's very positive sentiment, but you've lost ground in distribution and you have some work to do to kind of fuse consumer demand and trade awareness together. So we dug into that a little bit more, and really the decision was made to lift and do activities that were bigger in scale, more ambitious, to try to stand out from the crowd. So Aussie Wine Month starts in New York, and over the next month it moves to Miami, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco. So it picks the top wine-centric cities in the world, in the US, I should say, and, you know, in some of the most influential markets. And, you know, with the program in New York, we've got 1,200 consumers coming to the events over Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday nights. We've got a sold-out roadshow on Thursday, which is over 600 people from the trade, by far the biggest tasting that we've ever put on for the trade in the United States.
Aaron, what will the marker of success be here? Have you put a monetary target on where you'd like to be at come next year or in the next sort of few years?
Yes. So our current exports are $437 million, and that's been growing over the last 3 months. So that's growing in the kind of low to mid-single digits, which, okay, it's not setting the world on fire, but it is absolutely consistent with our strategy. By June 30, which is the conclusion of the package, we're absolutely optimistic that we can get back to that figure of $488 million that was provided to us when the government gave us the grant.
That was Wine Australia's regional general manager for the Americas, Aaron Ridgway. Well, now we're going to talk from the United States to Iraq now, because Iraq could soon be following some of the Riverlands irrigation practices. The Australian ambassador to Iraq, Dr. Joanne Lowndes, visited the region late last week to learn how the Riverland manages water for irrigation and how some of these practices could be used in the Middle Eastern country. She told Laura Collins there are practices in the Riverland that could help Iraq maintain a sustainable farming industry.
As ambassador to Iraq, I've done a little bit of travel that I can there, and I've spoken to, of course, Ministry of Agriculture, Ministry of Water. Ag is very important to Iraq. It's a large employer of women. But they too are struggling with the same things that we are here, and that's managing their two great river systems, which is the Euphrates and the Tigris, and how best to utilise that for their own agriculture purposes. You know, they've obviously been racked by war over several decades, not just the most recent conflict with ISIL, but before that as well. And so a lot of their infrastructure has been either neglected or destroyed, so they're trying to get that back on track. And so the purpose of coming out here in terms of looking at the irrigation side of things, and even dry land farming, actually very important for Iraq too, is to see not necessarily what the most modern techniques are that Australia is using, such as automation, fully automated systems, but to look at how over time the communities here have dealt with that and what some of their structures are around that. Because I think that's probably what Iraq is likely to need most. The modern technology will come, but I think we've got a few other steps to go before that, including, for example, even paying for water. A lot of Iraqi farmers don't pay for their water, so, you know, looking at the incentive structures that helps people manage their water resources better.
And I guess on the return to your role after the visit, what are you hoping to take away from the last 24 hours or so?
So I'll be going in to see both the Ministry of Water and the Ministry of Agriculture. I try and drop in on them on a semi-regular basis. And what I'd like to do is go back in and say to them, look, rather than jumping to some of the most modern technology, have we thought about, for example, giving regional communities in Iraq ownership over their water and letting them decide how best to use their water allocation, and seeing, for example, as a pilot program, whether that's something that can be done. There's a lot of interest from other parts of the international community in Iraq on this issue as well. The Dutch have been very interested, the Italians. Of course, the UN agencies such as Food and Agriculture Organization also very interested in that agriculture and water nexus. So I'll be talking to them about some of what I've seen here and our experiences. What Iraq does know and what the world does know is that Australia has a lot of expertise to offer when it comes to water management and agriculture and water management. Even just talking yesterday to both CIT and RIT and others is telling me about the delegations that have been through here. So previously from Iraq, there have been delegations through here from Nepal, from India, from Pakistan, from Vietnam. And that highlights to me how well known our expertise is and how we can send that to the rest of the world.
And it is a high production area in the Riverland of many different products. One of those is dates, which I know is a high demand product in the Middle East. Is the Middle East, and particularly Iraq, is it a bit of actually, a forgotten or a missed opportunity in some ways for exporters that maybe they haven't quite realised yet the opportunities that do exist in these areas?
Missed opportunity is probably not quite right yet, because definitely we have a large number of exports to the Middle East more broadly, you know, places like Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. Iraq does have opportunities. Bega, for example, is exporting dairy there. We do export wheat to Iraq. But I am approached by average Iraqis who say, I remember when we used to be able to buy X product from Australia, you know, how come you're not exporting to us anymore? And again, it goes back to that, to the conflicts that Iraq has gone through. It's previously had sanctions on it when Saddam was in power. And so it's just a case of, I think, now that Iraq is starting to recover, it's now part of my job is to encourage people to take a fresh look. Of course, there are still challenges with dealing with a market like Iraq, but, you know, to take a fresh look and see what's possible, especially those who are already exporting or investing in the region. It's then a case of perhaps casting your eye just a little bit further to Iraq as a market. So there are opportunities. But of course, like any opportunities, it ends up being a commercial decision, and they people need to think about what the risks and challenges are, and then consider whether those risks and challenges are worth the time and effort that's required to establish a new market.
That's the Australian Ambassador to Iraq, Dr. Joanne Lowndes, and she was speaking there with Laura Collins. Well, settling down to buy a house or packing up to travel the world, it's the crossroad that many millennials find themselves at. Photojournalist Talia Stebbins and her partner Jordan Facer chose adventure and moved to a station just outside the small outback New South Wales town of Whitecliffs, which has a permanent population of less than 100 people. After a day of governessing and drafting sheep, they told reporter Saskia Mabin they can't imagine ever returning to the big smoke.
Just a change of pace, a bit of a sea change, as they call it. Nowhere really near the sea, I suppose.
Far from a sea change, it's kind of a desert change, is that a thing?
Yeah, I suppose so. I don't know, I've been a carpenter for a couple of years now and just sort of chasing something a bit different while we're young and we can. No regrets yet. Ask me in the middle of summer, but yeah, no regrets yet.
We sort of decided that we're at the point in our lives where we wanted to either sort of really settle down and look at buying a house and stuff like that, or, you know, set out on a bit of an adventure.
It's kind of a crossroads moment. And so you chose to come out to the middle of the outback and do something totally different. How did you end up choosing this place? Was there something special about this?
We were sort of just looking for station hand jobs. I really wanted to sort of get out of the office and be, you know, on the land and do something in the sunshine a bit more. And I still get that as a governess. You know, obviously I'm in the schoolroom with the kids, but, you know, in recess at lunchtime, before and after school, we're, you know, out on the trampoline playing with the dogs or, you know, taking the motorbikes for a ride. So it's been a really nice change of life.
How different is this lifestyle from what you were doing before in Bundaberg?
Yeah, incredibly different. You know, I used to be awake at 5 o'clock in the morning. I used to go to the gym, get to work, you know, by about 8:30, and then, you know, probably stay until after dark a lot of the time. And I wasn't seeing a lot of sunshine in my day, and that sort of impacted on me a little bit. And I wanted to make a bit of a change before I committed to that lifestyle for the rest of my life, if that's what I intend to do.
And you've lived in Brisbane as well, which is city, so you've kind of experienced, I guess, three different environments, Brisbane, Bundaberg and here being the most small and isolated place. Can you imagine living in a place like Brisbane again after being out here?
Honestly, I can't see myself moving back to the city. It was great. It was a great 8 years. I was able to learn a lot about myself and where I wanted to go in life. I've picked up a lot of skills in the city and it's been invaluable to me. But the concrete jungle, I don't think, is for me anymore. I'm much enjoying the wide open spaces of country life.
As a govvy out here, do you get much of a chance to continue your photojournalism as a hobby?
Yeah, I do actually. A lot of the time I'll be carrying my camera around with. It's been awesome to get in the shearing sheds and pick up my camera and sort of get that nice sunset light while they're shearing a sheep. Yeah, it's what I wanted. It's what I was thinking about when I was moving out here. It's like, I want to get those shearing shed photos. And I've been able to get a couple, luckily. So yeah, it's been incredible and learning a whole heap of new skills.
So you've mentioned like a couple of the things that you like about here, but what's the best draw card for living in a place like this? If you were selling it to someone else, what would you say?
I think the freedom just to really become yourself. A lot of people out here, they're no muck about kind of people, and they just want to know who you are and what you stand for and why you are the way you are. And they'll most of the time accept you, warts and all. But I think it can be not intimidating, but I guess there can be a little bit of pressure, I think, when you're living in the cities to be like or be better than other people. And I think a lot of young people do fall into that trap of what does your life look like, and does it look better than someone else's, or does it look as good as? And I think out here, no one really cares. You know, it's just you're free to be you, and your passions are your passions regardless. And you know, you don't have anyone to impress out here. It's just, you know, the freedom to be you.
That's Talia Stebbins and Jordan Facer talking to Saskia Maven about their experience of leaving the city for a bit of a desert change. Still no love for the Teddies on the text line here on the Country Hour. Greg saying that they are a bit of an eyesore. These are the Teddies that are up on the York Peninsula at Paskerville. He's saying that they should they should get rid of them because they're fading and slowly rotting in the weather. That is all the time that we've got for the Country Hour. I will be back with you tomorrow, but in the meantime, abc.net.au/rural for more stories from across the country. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. We're heading up to 1 o'clock news time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.